On January 11th in Las Vegas, a jury sentenced neo-Nazi John Edward Butler to die by lethal injection. He had been convicted of the murders of two ARA supporters. Dan Schursty and Lynn Newborn were shot and killed in the desert outside Las Vegas, Nevada, on July 3, 1998. Both of them were anti-racist skinheads. A lot of people equate skinheads with neo-Nazis, but in fact the skinhead culture is rooted in mixed-race working-class communities. Their friends immediately suspected that neo-Nazis were responsible for their deaths. There had been escalating violence in the months leading up to the night of the murders. Lynn Newborn, who was known as Spit, was black and very vocal about his anti-racist convictions, and he was well known to the organized racists in the area. Dan Schursty, who was white, was Spit's close friend. In September 1998, murder charges were laid against John Butler, who was already in custody on charges of driving a stolen vehicle. Evidence against Butler included forensics linking a gun in his possession to the murders, as well as testimony from a jailhouse informant who claimed that Butler confessed to him. Others investigated but not yet charged include Butler's girlfriend Melissa Hack and her brother Ross Hack. Police searches of all their homes turned up lots of Nazi propaganda and weapons. The trial against Butler began on Thursday, November 30th. Evidence was heard well into December. Jury deliberations lasted 4 days before Butler was convicted on December 27th. Just before the trial began, Radio Antifa spoke with Cindy and Brandon, friends of Lynn Newborn. Cindy, in particular, has been active with ARA since the group formed in Las Vegas in the spring of 1998. First, we talked about growing up in Las Vegas, one of the fastest-growing cities in North America, its economy fueled by a booming tourist industry.
It's really isolated from, like, other towns, so it's not like you can go to another town and do anything really easily. And it's pretty transit, just so many people move in and move out and just back and forth, because the town actually kind of sucks, but...
Nobody takes the time to set anything up here, because it's pretty unstable.
It's really like a keep it to yourself, because everybody's here to rip you off or just get money, because that's what the town's based off of, and that's how the town grew, is ripping off people or taking advantage of other people, or anything like that. So it's like no one really took the time to create. There's not really much of a culture or community here, because it's all revolved around money, like the gambling and anything, any tourist thing that can happen is either happening or is going to be happening.
Cindy and Brandon are both involved with the punk subculture and have been for years. We asked them about the punk scene.
Like, the punk scene was diverse. Like, it didn't really matter. Like, back then, because it's changed now, but back then, like, when a couple years ago, like 93 or before 93, like, up to 97, I think, is when it started kind of splitting.
But it's a bunch of white, middle-class, suburban kids now.
Yeah, but before that, it was, like, anybody and everybody, and if you were punk, you were my friend. You know, it was because it was such a small scene. The scene was built into, like, basically a big family, you know, so it was like anybody within, like, either the skinhead scene or the punk scene and or the ska scene was like one big family. It's like we were pulling together to get a scene going, and, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, what background you had, you know, you're allowed to be, you're in the scene and you're helping out, and that's cool, and, you know, it was really nice.
Then we discussed Nazi activity in the area and why anti-racist youth have been attempting to organize against them.
Back when, in like, 93, when, like, you go to a punk show and the Nazis would rule, like, the pit and, like, the floor area and march around and see Kyle and yell white power, and all you have is, like, this 13-year-old kids compared to these huge guys can't do anything, you know? They can't, like, they just beat up on kids and you can't, like, not enough, like, manpower, basically, to fight back. You say something, you're just going to get knocked down and lose a few teeth or end up in the hospital or, like, anything else, like, you know.
Spit used to get right up in their faces when we played, like, seeing, like, right there in front of them.
I mean, people like Dropkick Murphys did that, and then kicked the guy's ass after the show. And eventually they weren't allowed in the venues anymore, is how I think it stopped for, like, the moment, because they weren't allowed to go to, like, these places.
We had to leave one of our shows because a bunch of them showed up with guns. for an Oi show. A business show.
Yeah. We're hoping to, like, stop the recruitment, basically, since they were going after kids in high schools and kids in junior high. And, like, show them that there's, like, another side, or show them that it was wrong, or whatever. Because, I mean, it's real easy, like, you come to, like, moving into Vegas and just not really having much to do, because there's not really a lot of stuff for the kids to do here. And if there is, it's, like, across town, or it's not that close. And our bus system really isn't that great to, like, just hop on a bus and go. So, being, like, this new kid in town and not knowing anybody and having these big skinheads who look all tough and, you know, like, hey, you know, you can be our friend, you can hang out with us, we'll protect you if you wear these white laces, you know, you wear the swastika, and you know, and, like, say, well, you see this person and, you know, like, they're going to take our jobs, or, you know, whatever belief they're going to, like, input in their head. But, like, to go from not knowing anybody in a big town or a big city, or to having, like, instantly 8 to 10 friends who are, like, big guys or, like, real tough looking and have that whole image and ego of being pretty tough and the whole power, you know, and being part of, like, this, like, a group that's powerful looking and they're tough and, you know, and, like, that whole, like, testosterone and, like, that whole image, you know, for, like, some little kid not knowing anything or not knowing anybody, it's, like, really easy. Well, what we were basically just doing, since we were really new when all this stuff happened, is we were just at show, like, tabling shows and just spreading the word that, or, like, holding shows, or we wanted to get in the high schools if it was possible, but there's so much, like, politics around it, it's not that easy. And with all the casinos and everything and all the tourism, they want to keep anything that's like, anywhere close to being, like, controversial, that wouldn't be good for the gambling industry. They just kind of want to sweep underneath the rug and ignore that it's there. So that made it a little more difficult, and that's what I think makes it more difficult for any kind of, like, activist group or anything like that.
But somehow the Nazis get in there.
Maybe it's because they're kids, you know? Maybe it's all the corporates, people in the casinos, kids are the ones who are doing it, and that's why it's okay. Like, I don't know.
Big conspiracy.
Yeah.
Lynn Newborn was loved by many in this community and respected for the political positions that he stood for and defended.
He was basically, he's a big guy, I mean, and a nice deep voice. He was very loud and very, like, boisterous, and wasn't afraid to voice his opinion. Mm-hmm. Wasn't afraid to let people know what he was thinking, basically, which is a lot more than a lot of people do.
No, I got stories, but I shouldn't share them.
I know he lived in California for a while, but I don't know if he...
Pomona, and he lived in...
Texas for a little bit, but...
He lived in Kansas, and he got shot in Kansas, too, by skinheads.
Dan Schursty worked at the Nellis Air Force Base in the northern part of Las Vegas.
Because he loved planes, and he wanted, like, his own plane one day kind of thing. And he lived in Florida, and that's where he's from. And so working with the Air Force was basically going to get him out of Florida, which is what he wanted, and just to get him away from that and be able to still work on planes and stuff. Kind of worked for the better for him. He lived on the base for a while, and then moved out and just had his house with another person who was in the Air Force and his girlfriend. When he came here, it just exposed him to so many new things, I guess, from being in a small town.
Tensions had been building among the Las Vegas youth scene in the months leading up to the double murder.
Another friend who's a skinhead went to the Double Down, which is a local, like, punk skinhead and rockabilly bar, and actually didn't even make it in the door when four skinheads jumped him and gave him, like, this nice concussion and had to go to rehab or physical therapy because they kicked him in the back of the head, so he couldn't feel, like, his legs for a couple days. and stuff. I think that was a big one. That was a month before Spit and Dad were murdered. But there were other, like, fights building up to it. Other run-ins, and drive by, you see Kylene's. Like, they'd drive around, or they'd drive by, and they drive around, and then, like, one guy would hop out and, like, see Kyle, and we'd yell at him, and then he'd hop back in the car, even though they're driving away already. Like, it was just bizarre. I kind of think it was just, like, an off-base theory that's just my own. But being 4th of July, being, like, the patriotic day, and having one of the girls who's a suspect in the case, having been arrested the year before for doing racial slurs and causing problems, it was all due to racism. Being around the 4th of July was a big thing for them to go and do stuff for their country and being, like, you know, keeping it white or whatever.
The night of the murders, two women invited Dan and Spit to a party. The women picked up the two men and drove them out to the desert. They weren't seen alive again. Dan's body was found the following day. He had been shot in the face with a handgun and then in the chest with a shotgun.
There were like 20 of us that always hung out at Spit's apartment. Like, that, like on the 4th of July, there was a skinhead barbecue that we were all going to go to, even though all of us weren't skinheads, but they didn't care. You know, it was all family. And so we all showed up at Spit's apartment. Since he wasn't found, we were hoping that he was still alive and, like, hoping maybe he'll show up there. And we're calling a friend in Arizona who lived down there, thinking maybe if something bad happened, maybe he was going to go there for help, you know, if he had to get out of town, you know. We had, like, no idea what was going on. And so we were just, like, this couple days, we were just basically, like, you know, the apartment, like, constantly calling each other if they heard anything, if they knew anything. You know, like, everybody who had, like, pagers or anything, or, like, by their phones, like, waiting for him to call. Because when his body was found, it was in the direction towards town, like he was running back, trying to run back towards town.
The police investigation was hampered, initially, by confusion about who Dan and Spit were and what they represented.
The detectives were actually kind of confused, because they were seeing, like, this bald white kid and then this bald black guy, you know, black kid, and then, like, seeing the patches on Spit's jacket that was still in Dan's car, seeing that it had, like, all these anti-racist patches and, you know, it was, like, and skinhead patches and stuff, and they were, like, kind of, like, they didn't understand, like, the whole, because they weren't really, like, they always automatically assume skinheads are racist. And so to see, like, stuff like that, they were saying that there's anti-racist skinheads, kind of confused them, the whole thing.
Reaction from the media was similar.
The media was shocked that there was, like, not all skinheads are racist. And so we had to explain subcultures, and they still can't get it right, but we had to explain subcultures to them, basically, and I don't know, the media seemed to sound like they had no idea what their kids are doing. Like, no idea of, like, what kind of scene or what, like, interest any of the kids have or anything like that. Like, the absolute, like, there's no clue. Like, the rest of the world has, like, no clue what kids do.
They're, I think, like, they kind of made it sound like two rival gangs.
Yeah.
The skinheads and the anti-racist skinheads. And they were always clashing, and it was inevitable that, you know, something like this would happen.
We asked Brandon and Cindy what they expected would come out of the trial about the overall significance of these murders. Brandon had spoken with a man who had served time in the same jail as Butler has been held in pretrial detention. According to him, inside that jail...
Basically, he's a god up there.
John Butler?
Yeah. Polar bear. If he doesn't, you know... If he just gets sentenced life, he's gonna have it easy. He's got, you know, people protecting him up there, and their own little racist community, so not even really punishment, I don't think.
Going into the trial, Brandon and Cindy were apprehensive about the future.
I'm halfway expecting some sort of retaliation.
Yeah,
when he's found guilty.
I expect a nice big uprising, and all these Nazis that are hiding will shave their heads again and put their braces back on. And
we're just doing, like, you know, dumb stuff now, like leaving voicemails and stealing Spitz grave marker. Yeah, someone stole his grave marker.
Actually happened, I guess, like a couple times.
I think no matter what happens in the trial, that all the skinheads here and probably a lot of other places are see this as a big victory for them. No matter what happens with the butler or anybody else.
Yeah, because according to them, they just opt one of the, like, the most vocal, like, bigger people in the anti-racist movement. So, like, basically, and, like, according to some people, like, they got rid of, like, the leader of the anti-racist movement in Las Vegas, so there's no, like, organization here, or, like, some BS. But I think it just let, for as many people as there's probably was involved, it just showed all the Nazis that you can get away with murder, I think. I was hoping to be, like, a nice big eye-opener for the city that racism still exists, and it's pretty tough, and that the city, like, pretty much is trying to ignore it and say that it never happened.
However, the Las Vegas ARA crew wasn't completely demoralized. They attended the trial and hearings daily, faced off with Nazi witnesses and supporters who also attended, and kept ARA supporters around North America up to date about all developments. They have remained committed to building an anti-racist movement in their city.
My best case scenario would be everybody else was involved, get arrested and tried, and found guilty. Mm-hmm. And, like, everybody else who was, like, just getting into the Nazi scene, or was, like, the newbies, would get scared and realize, I don't know, like, realize it and, like, get out of the scene. Or I think the Nazis had this concept of, like, if you get rid of the king, like, in terms of England, like, you get rid of the king, then you can take the whole country, but there's still, like, the parliament behind it, you know, and that kind of runs things. And so, like, they're like, here, like, we have no president right now, but Congress is still running things, you know? So they still didn't take out the whole country. They just took out one person.
This has been a Radio Antifa report for January 2001.